Want to know the difference between us and the machines? We bury our dead. Kyle Reese from The Terminator. Everybody, welcome to another episode of Felonious Pundits. I am Kentad Svensgaard, and along with me, as per usual, please say hello to Mr. AJ Mass.
The A does not stand for as per usual.
Oh, AJ, I am going to enjoy talking about this episode with you, but first I should tell the folks what they're here listening to. This is a podcast about the program Criminal Minds. Each week, we recap and take a look at an episode of the show. I have never seen the show before. I'm giving it that first watch perspective, while AJ has seen each and every episode many times. So we call him the grizzled veteran. And that's the perspective he'll be bringing to you. We are here to talk this week about Season 4, Episode 14 of Criminal Minds, entitled Cold Comfort. And this episode was written by Dan Dworkin and Jay Beatty, directed by Anna Forrester, a name I don't remember from ever putting in before. And this originally aired February 11th, 2009. If I had an alternative title for this episode, AJ, I think Cold Comfort is a fine title for this episode. However, if I were to name it, I might have named it The Smell of Embalm in the Morning.
Oh, very nice, very nice. I was torn between two alternate titles, being The B.A. Wu and The Wrong Island Medium.
Okay, so I suppose we should get into it, discuss this episode. Start off with seeing some rain. Rain, as we know, washes away things and creates evidence. And we cut immediately to an evidence board and see some pictures of some four young blonde women on it. Under three of the pictures, it says missing. And we see a detective who is writing under the other photo, deceased. We meet Detective Fullwood, and I had to laugh at that name because I'm immature, I guess. But that name made me laugh immediately.
He was promoted. He used to be semi-wood.
And played by Michael Biehn, Kyle Reese from the Terminator movie. As well as several other things.
Oh, you know, you're gonna run out of your voice here with all this played by this week.
Yes. Oh, definitely. One thing I kind of felt, Criminal Minds must have been really popular at this point, having some extra budget, because the guest stars in this episode, when they could have just got, you know, strong character actors to play small parts, They went kind of all in on let's get as many stunt casting or well-known guest stars, should I say. I won't call it stunt casting.
Indeed.
Because in the first 90 seconds of the episode.
Terminator gonna terminate, yo.
So a cop comes in and tells Detective Fullwood he's got a visitor. And at first he's not interested, but when he finds out it's Sandra Lombardini, that last name matches one of the girls that said missing. He says, oh, I'll see her. So she comes in, and the first thing I say is, hey, Lolita Dedovich. Dedovich.
And then you pronounce it right, and you say Davidovich.
Davidovich. I've never pronounced it right, but hey, it's her. So yes, she is the mother, Sandra Lombardini. And immediately, Sheriff Fullwood tells her the body isn't Brooke. When she asks who it belongs to, it was Lynette Hagen. Obviously, she's, you know, knows all the details of all these cases. He says, look, you know, there's nothing really you can do. Just go home and get some rest. She can't sleep, not until she knows something. And also, she's there because she needs something from him. What does she need, AJ? She wants Brooke's necklace, which was found on the ground by her car, apparently. She needs it. The sheriff tries to explain, well, it's in evidence. That may be kind of tough. But you sense there's some kind of relationship between the two and just in him caring about her and wanting to help her out because of her situation. So he's going to try to get it for her, but he does ask her why she needs it. She says, well, he says that it can tell him things. We cut next to Sandra. Rain outside. She's walking up to a house. A lot of rain in this episode. A lot of rain imagery.
Just every scene. It is raining.
And yeah, this guy that she's going to see is named Stanley Usher, played by the great Vondi Curtis Hall. So we've got three well-known folks right away. First 90 seconds. He opens the door. He looks at her. We cut to him at his table. And he's feeling the necklace. So we immediately figure out what's going on here. He's feeling the psychic emanations from the necklace. And I just want to say here, Vondi Curtis Hall has one of the best faces in show business, in my opinion.
When he thinks, he is thinking. Like, yeah. There's no mistake about that. I mean, I guess it wasn't that difficult to get the necklace after all. My goodness.
Yeah, she was there immediately. She asks him, what is it? What do you see? We don't get to see what he says to that because now we're going to cut to Garcia and good old Kevin Lynch in the BAU office, checking out the daily horoscope. And Morgan and Prentice are there. So we're going to clearly set up some sides here immediately. They're poo-pooing the whole horoscope things. They can't believe those guys believe that stuff. And Garcia says that they're just jealous because they don't have that magic ingredient. And Prentice lets her know that she does have the magic ingredient. It's called Splenda.
Good old Prentice.
Kevin asks Prentice, well, what is her sign? And she's not interested in giving them that information. But Reed happens to be walking by, so Garcia knows. Hey, Reed, we need a DOB on Prentice. And Reed says, 7:12 a.m., October 12th, 19, at which point Prentice is like, hey. Because obviously she don't need Reed to be telling the year she was born. And that shuts Reed up. But Garcia is like, Libra, I should have known. She reads her horoscope. It's about a romantic opportunity. Might experience a slight hitch. And while she's reading it, Prentice does kind of look like, hey, maybe that has some meaning. But then all of a sudden she says, Garcia finishes the horoscope saying, you can end the cold front in this relationship with a simple but affectionate gesture. And Prentice says, I have a simple gesture. And then we see just her back, but we know what her simple gesture is. And that made me laugh. I enjoyed that little moment.
She's saying that they're number one.
And at that point, JJ comes up. Hey, let's get the information out of the way that this is JJ's first day back. Everybody's glad to see her. We get a little, oh, it's tough being away, separation anxiety talk between Garcia and JJ. And then Garcia notices a ring on JJ's finger. Help me with the pronunciation because I always mispronounce this. Citrine. Whatever the jewel is, whatever the gemstone is on this ring.
It's a gemstone. There you go.
Yeah. Apparently, it's Henry's birthstone. Little Henry's birthstone. And Will and JJ got this ring, and they think that's sweet.
Yeah, why didn't they read his horoscope? You'll be colicky today, and maybe dump in your pants.
So we get that scene, and then we're going to cut to the conference room to hear about the case.
JJ's back. Hey, JJ's back. That's the big story here.
Right. That's the good news. Next, we have JJ telling us the case. There's been a string of abductions in Olympia, Washington, going back 9 months. Four women, blonde, blue-eyed, early 20s. And this morning, they found the body of one of them. And this was the first one taken. And they're looking at the pictures and going, well, she looks almost mummified. No, JJ lets them know that the victim has been embalmed. So they're kind of having a tough time trying to figure out what the time of death was. The body was jarred loose during a mudslide. It's in Olympia, Washington. That's where they're gonna go because they figure the victims were taken every 3 months apart, and it seems like he's probably rotating his victims in and out. So there's probably more bodies in the same area. And we cut to some creepy-looking embalming preparations by an unsub. Obviously, we don't see the unsub yet. We just see a quick flash of getting ready to embalm, and then we have our credits.
Criminal Minds, Criminal Minds, Criminal Minds, Criminal Minds. It's Criminal Minds. I find it very exciting that it took 9 months for this first victim to be mummified, whereas we know it took JJ 9 months to be mummified. And
oh no,
they both arrive on the same day. Look at that.
All righty, let's cut now to the BAU jet flying. And oh, the opening quote, I really
it's a very short one, isn't it?
Oh, God. And so, all the night tide, I lay down by the side of my darling, my life and my bride, and the sepulcher there by the sea, in her inner tomb by the sounding sea, Edgar Allan Poe. I faded out, Age.
Poe, Edgar Allan Poe, Poe. Ah, yes. That Poe.
Any comment on that as an opening quote? Not really.
Well, you know, Poe was another one of these writers who was of the time of ghosts and spirits and the supernatural. And is it true and is it not true? So I guess it's thematically appropriate.
Okay. So they're on the jet. The jet conversation begins with some talk about what's the process if you're going to embalm a body. And what they figure out from that is you need special equipment. You need training. You need some kind of knowledge. So maybe we're talking about a doctor or a nurse or a technician. Somebody with a background in mortuary sciences, says Hutch. Prentice is kind of turned off by the whole embalming thing. She would rather just be cremated. Hotch is saying, well, why would someone want to embalm the body of someone they murdered? To which Rossi says he wants to hold on to them. It must be some kind of possession issue. So this way they can never leave. But eventually, you know, an embalmed body will decay. And now this guy's going to find himself in need of new victims. And Hotch says, well, that would explain why he has to take someone every 3 months. And they figure out from that means maybe two of the remaining women are already dead. And the third is Brooke Lombardini. And it's been 4 days. She's been the most recent kidnapped victim following her shift at a local restaurant. And Reed says, we know that 90% of all the abduction victims are killed within the first 36 hours.
Yeah, so she's probably already dead, except for the fact that we've got this 3 month cycle that we think is it would have been nice if they had said that, you know, and the embalming fluid, you know, really preserves you for 3 months and then you start to go bad, mm-hmm. which is either true and should have been pointed out or not true, which means this whole theory is malarkey, but okay.
Exactly. Yeah. So next we go to a forested, hilly area. We see investigators searching the scene, evidence flags all over the place, dogs, and et cetera, the whole rigmarole.
And it's raining.
It's raining, yes. Kill. A police detective is there. He's telling Morgan and Reed that there was a hiker who found a foot protruding from the soil. and the whole side of there was apparently a mudslide right there, and that's how the hiker saw this, and that's why they're searching here. And the detective says, yeah, but this guy's got, you know, 800 acres to work with. And Reed lets him know you should keep your men near this area here. And they point out it's a lot of dead weight to be carrying a body. You're not going to go that far from the path. Typically, that's why a lot of killers dismember their victims, says Reed, because they're easier to dispose of that way. And the detective says, well, do you think it says something about his profile that he didn't chop her up? While Reed is saying, oh, yeah, probably Morgan is busy finding all these police investigators. And Morgan is the one who finds a little cross under some dirt, under some mud.
In 2.2 seconds after arriving. Come on, man.
So he's looking at it, and the detective is asking him what it is. But before he can answer, another detective comes up and says, hey, we got something up here. Now, AJ, something, we got something. It's a face poking out of the mud. Wouldn't you say more than I think we have something? Like, that sounded like, oh, maybe we got a clue. Maybe we found a shoe, a little, you know, something. Not, oh, another body.
Yeah, you're there looking for three other victims, potentially, at this point. Because there are three girls missing that you do not have their bodies. Yeah, I think you might want to not do a, hey, we're on TV, let's write a script where we want to make sure that there's a reveal.
I do want to say I enjoyed the purple scarf Reed had on. It was quite fashionable.
Yeah, he's looking stylish. Reed's fashion over the years is always going to be something to note. But yeah, so basically, Morgan and Reed arrive. Morgan finds jewelry in 0.2 seconds, and then 0.3 seconds later, they find the second body.
Yes.
Wow. Convenience is really working today. It's almost as if this cop's horoscope this morning said, you're going to find the second body, but don't brag about it or nothing. Be coy.
So next, we cut over to the detective Fullwood. He's walking with Prentice and Hotch. Apparently, they're outside the restaurant where Brooke worked. The important details we find out about this restaurant is that it's a really hoity-toity upscale restaurant. So it's somewhere that hoity-toity people would go. Hotch, because Prentice says to Hotch, well, what are you thinking? And he's saying, these women are taken as they left work. And you had one that worked at a high-end spa, one that worked at a jewelry store, one that works at this great restaurant. So, you know, it's probably somebody that would frequent those type of places. That helps them with their profile a little bit. Prentice is reading the report. She notices that they recovered a necklace by the car. She asks Detective Fullwood about it. He says, oh, yeah, we found it right over here. Hotch says, well, was it processed? And he says, Fullwood says, well, we couldn't get anything from it, just some hair in the clasp. It was hers. Hotch says, oh, well, sure, I'd sure like to take a look at it. And he says, yeah, well, I gave it back to her mother. And immediately Hotch is like, isn't that a little soon in the case to be returning evidence? And he's saying, Fullwood says there was some special circumstances. She hired someone and they're thinking maybe it's a private investigator. But no, he tells them it's a psychic. And the looks on Prentice and Hotch's face are like, oh, great.
Not one of these. Did you happen to notice the name of the linen services company on the truck in the background that was being worked on by these people in the background?
I did not.
That would be Bernero Linen Services.
Oh, no. Edward.
Shout out to exec producer, Edward Bernero.
Wow. Nice.
I noticed it. I look in the background of these things. It was cute. Hey, look at us.
Yeah.
Being funny.
So next, we're going to cut to a TV screen image of Sandra giving a press conference. We will see later that it's JJ, Rossi, and Morgan who are watching this press conference. She's saying she knows Brooke is still alive. She's doing one of those numbers where you talk directly to the the unsub in your press conference. She's saying it's not too late for you to do the right thing. Let her come home to me. She turns 27 on Wednesday. And Rossi's like, man, I wish she waited till we were able to coach her. And JJ's like, well, you know, she's actually doing a pretty good job, probably doing what JJ would have coached her to do.
Yeah, this is JJ's job to coach the people to do the pressers. So shut up, Rossi.
Yeah. And Rossi basically is like, chances are all of this is too late. And JJ's like, hey, well, look, she's got to have some hope, right? And Rossi's like, hope is one thing, false hope is another. So there's some kind of bug up Rossi's butt from like from the moment he learned a psychic was going to be involved.
Okay, and I'm fine with that. He's just his attitude towards, you know, this woman who's believing in it is a little unfortunate. But I am disappointed in Rossi for saying, ah, she's dead. We can't hope for that.
<You know? laughs> Right.
Even though he is probably right. I'm fine with him going psychic suck. And I'm a little disappointed in JJ going, well, I don't know, maybe psychics. JJ, you're supposed to be the good one here. Maybe psychics. Come on, JJ.
And that scene ends with Rossi saying, when people are vulnerable, they'll believe a lot of things.
True.
So, there you go. We next cut over to Sandra's house, and JJ and Rossi are there talking to her, and also Stanley Usher. Yeah, is there? Listen,
Usher Raymond, 2 stars.
And JJ is saying, "Look, we think JJ is being very like good cop. I guess I would say." Very nice to Sandra. She's saying, we think it may have been a customer that may have done this. And Sandra's like, you know, why are you guys basically talking to me? You guys, you have clues, meaning the information that Usher has given them. And those are the clues from her necklace. And Usher's trying to explain to Rossi. He's very polite. He calls him sir and everything. It's called token object reading or... And Rossi's like, yeah, psychometry, it's not my first, you know, rodeo. I've been working with a psychic before. And the clues that he got were a fenced-in area, the color orange, and the numbers 8, 6, and 7.
And yes, yes. Now, you've seen the episode.
Yes.
Now, yes. Did fenced-in area, orange, or 8, 6, 7 come into play at all? This entire episode, even after the fact, when we found the unsub.
AJ, I did not. If it did, it was very subtle.
Oh, no, it did not.
Because I did not see it.
No, it did not. Not at all. Not in the slightest, unless you can twist and torture your way into it going, yeah, well, the embalming fluid was orange. No, it did not.
And so JJ is still kind of, oh, so you believe by touching an object, you can see if someone's alive or dead. And Usher starts to explain it to her. And JJ wants to know if he got anything about her condition, anything else. And he says she felt tired, weakened. She, I don't know, heavy. And Rossi is not having it. He's like, oh, yo, I got to talk to you a second. Pulls him to the side. And he's like, look, I've been around and I've seen guys like you come into the lives of these grieving families. And while he tries to defend himself, Rossi cuts him off and says, look, the last thing this woman needs is some con man giving her unrealistic ideas. To which he replies, with all due respect, you may not know what she needs. Your job is to know the perpetrators. And when Rossi says, we're not talking about my job, he says, well, we should be, because there's a lot of people out there who don't believe in what you do either. And I was like, ooh, touche, Vonday Curtis. Paul. I mean, he's not exactly, right. You know. Yeah. But
he is right. Rossi, a lot of the theories that they come up with is pulling stuff out their rears, certainly. But at least there's evidentiary support for what they're doing, as opposed to fenced in area, orange, 8, 6, 7, heavy.
Yeah.
Which is A, all they've got, and B, has prevented this woman from answering any of their questions to actually potentially give them information that might be useful, because she's like, you're not following Usher's clues. He's talking about this Canadian boy who is going to be a really big singer someday. Why aren't you following him? I'm a believer.
Oh, no. So next. AJ.
Well, you stole, yeah.
Let's cut to some morgue. And we've got to see, like, these gross three embalmed but, you know, decayed, mummified-looking bodies, which I didn't necessarily need, but it's the girls that they have found. And Morgan is there and Reed with the medical examiner. And apparently the cause of death was blood loss, which meant that they must have been alive when they were embalmed.
Ew.
Yeah. And the medical examiner says, yeah. And they had significant levels of barbiturate, which means they were sedated, probably unconscious. Meanwhile, Morgan's noticing that all of the girls' hair has been cut to look the same. And Reed has pictures and they don't match the hairstyle. So that means that the unsub must have cut the hair. And also, the Emmy points out that all of the girls had their ears double pierced. Morgan asks if they were sexually assaulted, and the Emmy is like, not exactly. There's not any tearing or bruising that would suggest that, but he did find trace amounts of semen, which Reed goes, you mean it was consensual? And the Emmy has to be like, no. And Morgan says, she's saying that we were dead, that they were dead. And thankfully, at that moment, we got to a break.
Well, and I will say, before they cut to the break, Reed does look appropriately disgusted by that news, thankfully. Yeah. He's like, you know, it's almost refreshing. It's like, oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Yes.
Because why would one immediately think of that? The fact that something can still disgust Reed is actually kind of nice in a yes. weird way.
Let's go back to the police station. Now, the evidence board we get a quick look at, and the three pictures have the word deceased under them now, and just the one picture of Brooke says missing still. JJ has talked to the victims' families and found out that none of them had double piercings before they were taken. So that means that the unsub is cutting their hair and piercing their ears. He's changing them around. He's changing them into somebody, they figure. And Morgan says, well, look, the way he's burying them, it suggests an affection for the victims. So they figure he's probably trying to remake them into the image of someone that he loved. JJ wants to bring up the barbiturate because of what the psychic said, because he said they felt heavy. And Rossi is immediately like, yo, JJ, why are we talking about the psychic? It's a scam and you're falling for it. And JJ is like, look, he said Brooke's alive. I guess I want to believe him. And Hutch says, JJ, look, you know the profile. We're talking about a necrophiliac. And that means they usually wouldn't have any use for a live victim. And then Rossi calls Garcia before they walk off to the profile just to tell Garcia he wants her to run a background check on Usher, Stanley Usher.
Yes. You know, I almost wish Rashi would have gone a little harder on JJ there going. You'll notice that the board says missing, not heavy. Because that's not a clue. So yeah, there's that. He could also think she weighs 300 pounds. We don't know. Maybe he's trying to feed her. Like, it's taking away from the profile, which admittedly is also kind of speculative sometimes. Mm-hmm. Granted. But again, she's not in a fenced in area. 867. What's
867?
That could mean just about anything. She's playing blackjack and she has 21. could mean anything.
So we go to the profile scene, which, yeah, okay, they found some DNA, but it doesn't match anybody. They think he's a white male in his mid to late 20s that has money, lives alone in a large place because he would have space for his whole embalming lab set up to have. They think he's an awkward person, which is common in necrophiliacs, and they believe he's trying to recreate someone he once loved, like a girlfriend, wife, or mother. And then Reed says, well, this is just like Ed Gein. And we have to have a whole flash, not flashback, but a whole scene while Reed is explaining some actor that's playing Ed Gein, the notorious serial killer.
A little much in this episode. We got all these guest stars, and we decided instead of like using them anymore, let's have some guy play Ed Gein. Like, really? Wow.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with this case.
Wow. So, yeah. Prentice has a list of reports that she gives to the cops they're going to want to follow up on. They're also going to want to look for, because of the necrophiliacs, apparently 60% of them work in the death business, which, okay, I guess it makes sense. So they want to check out cemeteries, mortuaries, morgues, et cetera, et cetera. And Morgan says, and since we have the killer's DNA, we're going to have you swab potential suspects. And he says, Hotch says, the odds of finding Brooke Lombardini alive are slim, but the quicker we identify the killer, the better her chances are. So for her sake, let's work fast.
Yes. And you'll notice nowhere in their profile did they say, all right, now let's look for people who's have a first name with 8 letters, middle name with 6 letters, and last name with 7 letters who work near an orange grove.
No. Then we get, I like how they're telling the cops what they've got to check out. But then the only scenes we see are, of course, of the BAU going to check out all the stuff that they just told the cops to check out, which, of course, they're going to go out and do it as well. They're not just going to hand out all the busy work.
So let's go on our death business montage.
Yes. First, we see Morgan talking to a guy called Nervous Mortician. Apparently, he's talking about a previous lawsuit. And he's saying, look, that was a joke. It's my job to prep the deceased. I was simply adjusting her clothing. And it's like, dude, Morgan is not interested in that. He's not here. He's not there to judge you right now, which is exactly what he says.
Additionally, Morgan isn't even like, look, trust me, what you've done, that ain't even freaky deaky.
Yes. Morgan says, look, I'm looking for a killer. And he holds up a little swab. So if you want to prove that you're innocent, all you got to do is take a quick little swab. So that's Morgan's scene in the montage. And then we see Reed, and he's talking to a maintenance man, gravedigger. I don't know. He works at the cemetery, and he's telling him that they're looking for instances where graves have been disturbed. And this gravedigger is saying, that really hasn't happened. There was one older grave that got robbed. Someone made it off with the jewelry and the dress, but, you know, not much going on there. Then we cut over to Hotch, who's talking to an embalmer or some guy that works, a doctor type, the suit type that would do the embalming, I guess. He's saying, he's not going to lie, it does happen in the industry, so we know already what they're talking about, the necrophilia. And he's like, it's the kind of thing we put a stop to. And Hotch is like, well, you don't report that to the police. And the guy is honest, at least. He's like, well, we kind of don't really want to draw any attention to that. We want to handle that internally, basically. To which Hotch kind of chastises him. Maybe that's not the best way to go. People are getting killed here.
Sure, maybe that's not the best way to go. But then again, it's like, listen, sir, you don't work in this industry. We already get called names and people think we're creepy and believe this stuff about us. Like, let's not perpetuate the myth when it happens to be true.
One thing he does say is that this killer is dressing up the victims, and that does put a spark of memory in this guy. And he's saying, well, you know, there was a guy that we hired a while back that was kind of creepy, and I didn't like the attention he paid to the female cadavers, and he found out that he liked to do their makeup, and he put a wig on him. And Hotch says, "Oh, can you describe the wig?" And no, he's got it better, AJ. He doesn't need to describe it. They cleaned out his locker when he was fired, and so we cut to him with a box and pulls out this blonde wig and gives it to Hotch.
There's definitely some irony there that this guy wigged me out because he wigged them out.
Yes, indeed.
Gives me the wiggins.
And as we're leaving that scene, Hotch is asking him for whoever this guy's name is. So that means we're going to cut to a rainy night.
A really cool artsy shot, though, of three umbrellas arriving on scene. But it's still raining. And yes, they have one Ivan Bakunin in their sights.
Yes, they ring this bell. Ivan Bakunin is behind the screen door. He answers. He's like, can I help you? And Detective Fullwood is like, you could invite us inside. It's a little wet out here. And Ivan says, oh, I can't. Mother's sleeping. Immediately gave me Norman Bates vibes. So Hotch says, look, we're looking into some murders in the area. And we think the killer works in your field. And he's like, oh, geez, do I know him? And Prentice says, you might. His victims are your type. Blonde hair, blue skin. That made me laugh.
Emily's on fire this episode. I'll give you that. She doesn't have a lot to do, but she's on fire.
And Ivan immediately is like, oh, wait, you guys are way out of line. And they say, well, maybe you would give us some of your DNA. And he's like, no, I don't think so. And Hotch is like, you know, we can get a warrant. And Ivan, he said all he's going to say. He's closing the door on him.
In fairness, I think Ivan's pretty smart here. It's like, you know, yeah. In fairness, we can go get a warrant. We can get a warrant. Like, yeah, you do that.
Yeah, exactly. So next we cut to back to the PD, and Prentice is on the phone with Garcia asking if she's if she's got anything on Ivan Bakunin. Garcia doesn't have anything much except for he was expelled from college for assaulting his girlfriend. And Hotch says, was it sexual? And he says, well, he was giving her tranquilizers and having sex with her when she slept. To which Prentice says, that qualifies.
Again, now, mind you, she's got his report card, his grades, a transcript of some sort on the screen, which is handwritten, which is like, okay, so if it's handwritten, how do you have it digitized? But okay, I'll go along with that. If he had not been expelled for the illegal sexual exploits, those grades were getting him kicked out. My goodness. The man may have had maybe one grade of over 80. Everything was like 70s and high 60s, low 70s. He was going to flunk out. My goodness, his grades were bad.
So before she hangs up, Garcia has to make a crack. Oh, Emily, maybe this is the romantic encounter your horoscope was talking about. And Prentice is just laughing. Bye, Garcia. And it just seemed kind of tonally off with the rest of the scene.
Tonally off, because we are talking about, you know, he drugged his girlfriend and had sex with her while she was passed out. Like, ha, 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 ha.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe is Ivan's birthday qualify for this horoscope, which isn't really for today? And again, tortured. If you are a believer in this stuff, and I don't know why you'd be a believer, and I know, look, a lot of people these days subscribe to this, you're wrong. I'm not even gonna sugarcoat it. Bullshit. It's bullshit. It's just bullshit. Stop it. They're not saying anything. This is broad generalities. Stop it. But even this doesn't fit. It doesn't fit.
It doesn't. It does not. I agree. But anyway, Fullwood is all gung-ho, you know, say, hey, we got the wig. We can arrest this guy. We can get a warrant.
A warrant.
Hotch is like, well, you could, but I think you're basically wasting your time. And he's like, why? And they explain that according to the profile, they're looking for a rich guy. And Ivan hasn't held down a job since he left college, lives with his mother, doesn't have a car. You know, all the embalming stuff, that's not cheap. You're going to have to pay for that. Fullwood is like, yeah, but he likes to get it on with dead people. You know, that's a problem.
Here's the thing. He's not our guy. You might want to bring him in because he's probably done some shady stuff. don't just let him sit out there. Like, he might not be the most pressing issue. That's really what Hotch is saying here. He's not our guy. Feel free to bring him in at some point, but maybe not tonight.
Exactly. But JJ comes in at that point to let them know that they just got a 911 call, and apparently it was someone that was claiming to be Brooke. So we cut to Fullwood and Rossi, JJ, and Hotch, and they're in the room with Sandra, the Brooke's mother, Lolita, and they're listening to this emergency call. The voice is whispering because she's saying, he'll hear me. She can't talk too loud. It's Brooke This is Brooke Lambertini. Please, I need help. She can't give much more information. You can hear, please help me, she says. And then you can hear like a door. So you can tell she's going to have to get off the phone. And immediately after they listen to this call, Sandra is saying, that's her. That's Brooke. And Hotch is like, are you sure? And Rossi's like, she barely hear her. You can't really identify a whisper. And Sandra's saying, well, look, you think I don't know my daughter's voice? And Fullwood says, and why would someone who wasn't Brooke call in and say that they were? To which Rossi is like, sometimes people want to put themselves inside the story and they want to.
Is this your first day on the job, detective? Like,
jeez. Yeah.
No one ever calls the tip line with a fake story they made up.
But Sandra is still sticking with what Stanley Usher told her. He said she was alive. This proves it. And Rossi is like, he has a vested interest in telling you your daughter is alive. And she says, well, do you have a vested interest in telling me she's not? And at this point, Rossi has to bust out. Well, he has a record. I had a colleague look into it. He hands her a criminal record of Stanley. This reminded me of the scene in Ghost where they give Whoopi Goldberg's rap sheet to Demi Moore to say, look, you're looking at a psychic. Look, he's been arrested. I think maybe has every psychic been arrested for being a con artist? Anyway.
I mean, it's quite possible. It's a high probability. Rossi, come on, man. Rossi can have these views because he's right, generally speaking, but you don't talk to the kidnapped girl's mom and say these things. Wait till she leaves as like, yes, it's very hard to identify the girl's voice because she's whispering. True that. And no, this does not prove that Usher is right because you got a phone call and she wants to believe it's her daughter's voice. And yeah, he's got a fraud. Sure, this is not the time to bring this up to her.
Exactly. And it was like he had it with him. He was like ready for it. Like he was going to do this the whole time. Otherwise, he wouldn't have had that file with
him. You wait till he's in a room with the detective and you go, oh, and when were you going to bring up your fraud charges?
That would have been good. Instead, as JJ says to Rossi, look, all she had was hope because she's already left at this point. And why would you take that from her? And Rossi does look a little chastened by JJ, but that's that scene anyway.
Yeah, look, and again, it's also putting JJ on the I'm going to buy the psychic now because Rossi's being mean, which is not how you want this to work. This is not how the team operates. So Rossi's just not doing a good job. They're painting with a really bad guy brush this episode. Mm-hmm. And sure, you can do that if you want, but It's almost as if they're going, you know, a lot of our viewers of this show believe this stuff because Touched by an Angel was also a hit on this network. But let's make Rossi the bad guy. And it's like, come on, man. Stop it.
Next, we cut to the criminal lair. I don't know where we are. We're in a room. We
it's
see a bed.
In orange area, right? 867 on the wall.
Yes. And Brooke is laying out on a bed. We hear the unsub talking. You know, most people think that a person's hair and nails continue to grow after they're dead, and that's a myth. And he's stroking her face. She was asleep at this point, but as he's stroking her face, Brooke wakes up. And we see that our unsub has a pair of scissors and he's calling her Abby. He's saying, hold still, Abby, hold still. I know how much you like a straight line, talking about cutting her hair. And Brooke is like, who's Abby? And then he says in a very unsubby voice, you are silly.
You are silly goose. And this week we get our first good look at Brooke, really, in this scene. And it is another guest star. It is Mercedes yes. McNabb of Buffy/Angel fame.
Harmony,
indeed. It's delightful to see her back on my TV screen after all this time.
Two Whedonverse alumni in one episode. Who could ask for anything more?
Three. I could ask for three. We're not three. Okay.
So after we come back from a break, we get Prentice at the police station, and they weren't able to trace the 911 call that came in, but they did narrow it down to a certain radius just southeast of Seattle. They tried to triangulate, but they couldn't. Garcia couldn't clickety-clack for whatever reason, because he probably turned off the phone when he found her with it.
As you know, we need a certain amount of time for Garcia to be able to clickety-clack these things. A certain amount of time, unless, of course, she needs it immediately.
But still, Rossi is coming in with the, if he found her, like, you know, like the whole thing, everything is BS. But Hotch says, look, homeboy, Dave, I agree with you on the whole psychic thing. However, Sandra did identify her voice. We have to go on the assumption that it actually was basically like, let's.
And even so, it's like, why not go on the assumption at this point that she's alive? Let's be optimistic here. Look, because if she's dead, we got no evidence to go on until right. We find the body, which might not be for who knows how long since we've disturbed the dump zone of this unsub, which means he's probably going to find a new one at this point because he's aware it's been disturbed, and therefore we are never going to find this body. So let's work on the assumption she's alive because it's the only thing that's going to get us evidence at this point.
Right. So then they discuss why he could possibly be keeping her alive, and they figure out, well, he's got to finish whatever this transformation is. But he's had her for like almost 5 days, so it can't just be the makeup and the piercing. That's only going to take a couple of hours. So it's got to be something more than just her appearance. Reed says, sounds like on the phone, she sounded like she was drugged or something. And that's what happens in sexual slavery, brainwashing. So maybe what he's trying to do, they figure out, is make her change her identity. So he's waiting for her to become the person, whoever it is. In this case, I would say it would be Abby that he keeps yes. calling her.
Abby Normal. just Abby.
So the longer she actually holds out and doesn't become that person, the longer she's kept alive. So Hotch says, yep. And as soon as she accepts her new role, her fate is sealed.
Which is to me, that's the kind of interesting part of this episode, is that because she doesn't know that accepting this Abby role is going to be her death sentence. And you know, your instinct might be to hold out at first, but at some point you're like, well, maybe I'll switch tactics and I'll play along and become this Abby person, because then he'll treat me nice. And maybe that's what I need to do when you're unwittingly signing your death warrant. That's the interesting tension, I think, in this episode.
Agreed. We do cut back to the lair briefly, and the unsub is telling Abby to tell him a story. You know, I can't sleep without a story. Very childlike voice. He says this. Brooke is like, let me out. Can you just let me out? No, first I need the story, Abby. And again, she's insisting she's not Abby. There's a mirror in there, which she is able to look in. She sees what he's done to her hair, cut it short. She sees that she's got two earrings now in each ear. And she's like, what did you do to me? And he just says, tell me a story, Abby.
She says, I got a story for you. Once upon a time, you let me go, the end.
Yes.
Is what she should have said, but yeah.
She says again, she's not Abby. And like you pointed out, that's where the tension is, because, yeah, keep saying you're not Abby. keep it up, girl. But she doesn't, of course, know that. We cut back to the police station. Prentice has found out that there were DNA results on all the swabs that they got, but none of them were a match.
A fruitless montage, if you will.
Yes. And at that point, Rossi sees Detective Fullwood, and he's walking in with Usher. And Rossi is pissed. What's he doing here? He grabs the detective. What are you doing? And the detective is like, I can't let my ego get in the way. I'm going to take any help I can get. And Rossi is like, look, I'm happy to be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I'm praying I'm wrong about Brooke, but I'm not wrong about this dude. And meanwhile, JJ has walked up to him and is like, Mr. Usher, good to see you again.
Which is fine. She's the liaison. You know, she's got to be nice to people. And you know, she knows that Rossi's could go off at any moment. So at least be nice to the guy.
And he's happy to see her, but he's here to go off with the sheriff. But as he's shaking her hand, he's feeling on her little ring. And as he's walking off with the sheriff, he says, congratulations, and then points at the, you know, his finger, like where the ring is. And JJ, I guess, is convinced by this that this guy knows his stuff. Like, he couldn't figure out that sometimes people get birthstones. And
well, and not only that, it's a ring on her finger. She still hasn't lost the baby weight. So he could, by that token, go, oh, must be a birth of a child, especially because it's... If he knows the birthstone and knows it's this month, 2 and 2 = 4 baby. Also, he didn't say congratulations on the baby. He just said congratulations. Maybe she's engaged. It's an engagement ring. Maybe it's a new ring. Like, he didn't give her anything. She just said, I do have this ring for congratulations. As opposed to, hey, it's a new ring on my fatter than normal finger, so it's sized to fit this baby weight full finger, which is why she probably shouldn't be wearing the ring, quite frankly. She should wait till she loses the baby weight and get a ring that fits her normally. But nevertheless, it don't prove nothing. And he didn't say anything. She filled in the blanks for him.
Mm-hmm. And then we see Fullwood go into his office, closes the door, and he's handing that blonde wig over to Usher to feel. Meanwhile, we cut back to the lair. Brooke is waking up and she's tied to a chair and she has a storybook in her lap. And our unsub is saying, tell me a story, Abby. Tell me a story so I can sleep. Brooke starts to read from the storybook.
Do you have some of the story here? Because this story was written by ChatGPT or something. This is the worst story I have ever heard.
Once upon a time, there was once a lad who went to look for a place.
Once upon a time, there was once? Once upon a time, there was once? Who wrote this crap?
He went to look for a place, and as he went along, a man asked him. He met a man.
Place. Oh, very specific. Are you a psychic? I'm sorry. This story angered me. So.
And the unsub is angered as well. And he's yelling at her, "You're not doing it right. You're supposed to do the voices."
But there are no voices yet. There was no dialogue. This was once upon a time. There was once a lad. Now, if the lad spoke and said something, then do voices, sure. There are no voices for the narrator part.
And Brooke is like, "Just tell me what you want. I'll do it." And he says, "I want Abby." And she says, "I'll be Abby. I'll be whoever you want."
No.
We don't want her to do that. He's got some kind of shutter, by the way, which all bad guys have in their lairs attached to the window. He shutters it and leaves because she's pissed him off, clearly. Yes.
Shutters, not a fenced-in area.
Abby's still tied up. She falls to the floor, and she's looking in the mirror. I'm sorry. I called her Abby.
I did. Oh, no. You stuttered that word, Kintad. It's your fault.
It's all my fault. Brooke falls to the floor, and she's looking in the mirror. And she's sobbing and she's going, "Abby, Abby." So I guess this is to show that the brainwashing is starting to work.
And that's fine. That you can do. I'm okay with that kind of situation here. But like, oh my goodness. Just tell me what you want. "I want Abby." But that's no. Tell me what you want. If you want Abby, be more specific.
Yeah. So we next see our cops. And they have
raincoat wearing cops.
Yes.
Because it's raining. I don't know if it is raining. It is raining.
They have with them Ivan. They have gone ahead and arrested him. Apparently he was trying to cross the border. So they Fullwood put a stop to that. And Hotch is like, "Well, are you going to charge him with anything?" And he's like, "Well, if he confesses, yes. If he doesn't, he won't be able to skip town while we await his DNA results." So JJ says, "Okay, well, we'll let the lab know we're going to have a sample coming in on the way."
And again, that's fine. They make it sound like this is the most ridiculous tactic. Again, they don't have another option here.
Right.
Test his DNA. It's fine. He was trying to flee the country. That does look suspicious. Maybe he's done something. So again, this is not bad copying other than the point that, you know, they've wasted, again, time with his wig in the reading. Mm-hmm.
And Rossi does ask the detective, "Well, what did he get off the wig?" Fullwood says, "Well, enough to know that that's one sick puppy in there," which, duh.
we already knew that.
Let's go to the interrogation, and we have Fullwood throwing the wig in front of Ivan. "What's up with this wig?" And Prentice is there. She says, "It's a magic wig. It changes the identity of the dead." Go ahead, Emily. Emily's got jokes this episode.
She's got bars this episode. Absolutely.
But Ivan is like, "What? I don't know what the hell you guys are talking about." Emily's saying, "Yeah, look, we know that's why you're putting the wig on the bodies in the morgue. It makes the fantasy real. Who are you trying to turn them into?" We do cut to see that Reed and Hotch are watching this interrogation, of course, from the outside. Fullwood is saying, "I've worked some sick cases of rapists, pederasts." And Ivan is like, I hope you're not grouping me with those awful people. And Fullwood is like, "No, you're probably the sickest of them all." And Ivan says, "Well, many people would argue this is a victimless crime."
Oh, man. We want to be on your side, Ivan, but no, we are not.
Prentice, meanwhile, shows him the pictures of the dead girls, and he kind of winces at him, and he's like, "I don't know who these women are. You have the wrong," and Fullwood says, "the wrong necrophile." And he says, and I'm ashamed to admit I laughed out loud when he said this, but he says, "I don't know who that is. I don't kill people. But what do you think? I'm the only guy in town who likes to crack open a cold one." I'm ashamed of myself, AJ. I should not have laughed at that.
They're setting up for comedy, I will say, with a lot of Prentice's jokes. But I mean, again, it's like there are ways where you can prove your point, and I can say, you know, you're not wrong. Yeah. It's you know, I'm gonna share a story. It reminds me of the time when I was at Syracuse University, and Derek Brower, who had graduated from the school the year before, and we knew who he was. He was on the basketball team. And Derek Brower came in, and he wanted to go upstairs to visit his girlfriend, and he said, "No, you have to sign in, because the rule is you have to sign in with ID, and someone who lives in the building has to sign you in." And he goes with all logic and honesty. Come on, man. You mean to tell me if someone tells you a 6'9" black guy raped somebody tonight, you wouldn't know it was me? I mean, he's not wrong. If that was the description that someone gave of an attack, sure, he's the guy we would immediately turn to since he's a 6'9" black guy coming to the building. But is that the way you want to frame this conversation, Derek? So yeah, he's not wrong. He's like, you know, I'm not a killer. I just crack open the cold ones when they're already dead. Okay, I get it.
Oh yeah,
is there a
better
way to phrase this?
Anyway,
we did not let Derek into the building that night.
Good. Prentice is talking to him, and Ivan is saying, "No, look, the wig isn't even the important part. For me, it's the shoes." Why the shoes? Because it's the woman who wore those particular shoes. And her name, AJ, was Sunny Rains. Fullwood has heard of Sunny Rains. It's the weather girl, the one that got killed in a car accident a couple of years ago.
Why? Why is it? Why is it that so many weather people, so many meteorologists have these names, these aptonyms, if you will? And it's true. Like some of them are because their parents were weather folk and named their child that way. You know, we got, you know, Stormfield is a case where, that was, father wanted him to be a weatherman and was a weatherman, and it was Frank Field and named his son Storm. Like, so Stormfield became a weatherman. Like, I get it. But why does it seem like they're always Sunny Rains? Hurricane Schwartz.
Yes.
Right, that was his name, was Glenn Schwartz. He just used that as a nickname. But nevertheless, why? Why?
I agree 100%. However, Ivan was working the slab when Sunny Rains came in, and a friend of his gave him the shoes, and then he grabbed the wig. But the shoes, that's what was important to him. That's what made it real. This is enough to set Reed off, though. Reed has figured out something. What the guy says he needs is a genuine article. And that makes him remember the one scene in the montage that was actually useful, but we didn't know it at the time. Oh, there was a grave that was robbed. What was taken? A dress and a pair of diamond earrings and a pair of pearl earrings. Two pair. Oh, double pierced ears. If our unsub is like him, he needs genuine articles from the true object of his affection to complete the fantasy.
Yes. Now, I'm going to say I appreciate that, you know, Reed went over to his notepad to get this information. Why would Reed have to? Reed has an eidetic memory. He would just, from sitting next to Hotch, you know, this reminds me of what the guy told me. He doesn't need to go check his notes. It's a minor quibble I have with this episode, because a normal person, yes, would have to check their notes. Reed would not.
I also think if you know already that the guy is doing the double ear piercings, to hear about two pairs of earrings being stolen from the body would be interesting as well. Maybe.
Now, maybe he's checking his work, double checking and everything. But what the guy said was jewelry. The guy in the montage said jewelry. He did not say two pairs of earrings, because that would have been too on the nose for us, the viewer, to figure it out.
Right.
So, I know. It's TV. It's TV.
So they find the name of the woman that had the grave robbed. Abigail Hansen.
good for us for figuring out that this must be Abby. They do not know it's Abby, so I'm glad, you know, I'm glad that they don't go, maybe that.
Right.
They got to do a little bit more work. But we now know they are on the right track.
So next we cut to Garcia, who has been clickety-clacking Abigail. She died at age 26 from a heart defect. She sends the photo on over to him, and blonde girl, so she looks the part. The other things that Garcia has to tell him is she was born in Amsterdam. She never got married. Her employment record shows she worked for Patrick and Leona Gless from 85 until her death in 1992.
I mean, why does she need to check her employment records for this? The entirety of the obituary is Abigail Hansen from Amsterdam died of a heart defect at the age of 26. She worked for Patrick and Leona Gless.
Wow.
And the next sentence is she has no known relatives in Amsterdam, but the Glesses are checking. That's not an obit.
Meanwhile, they ask Garcia to get the address for the Gless family. Might be the only ones that can tell us who Abigail was. And so that's their lead, and it's a hot lead. But first, before we see that, we've got to cut back to the lair. Brooke is reading the story. I guess she's doing it with a little more enthusiasm now.
She's certainly reading sweetly, as if she was a young lady reading to a child.
Yes. And then she finishes the story, happily ever after, the end. Our unsub opens the door, and it's the first time we actually can see his face. I mean, we don't recognize him, but
just
we see his face. Yeah. And he's holding up a dress for Brooke. And we get a voiceover to remind us, in case we forgot. We get Hotch voiceover. As soon as she accepts her new role, her fate is sealed.
Yeah. What color dress would you say this was? Because I'm colorblind-ish, so I couldn't really tell.
Orangey, burnt sienna.
Would you call it orange? Are you going to give the psychic a hit on this, or would you call it yellow and say he's off?
I thought it was a little orangey. That was my first
impression. This is what we do.
Maybe blush. You know,
sure, but
not straight up hardcore orange.
Right. OK. But even if we're going to say this is orange, right, she was not wearing this dress until right this second, which means that the orange thing is not a hit after all.
Yeah, I wasn't going to. Yeah, I wasn't giving the psychic any credit.
I just wanted to see if the show was trying to set up that all these things were going to come true. I was trying to read into it. But, so this is a way where you could, where it's not a hit at all. And yet you could give it credence. Let's go to commercial.
And then
let's back from commercial.
Come back from the commercial. Yes. We see a very luxurious looking lakefront home.
A mansion, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Rossi, Hotch are going up to the door. And Rossi's asking, what does Mr. Gless do for a living? And apparently he's a failed artist.
Hey, you know what I say about calling someone a failed artist? People who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones.
Ooh.
Boo me.
Sharon, better watch her step. the only glass I know. Sorry. Anyway, we see Mr. and Mrs. Glass. I looked up Mr. Glass because I knew him from something. Had no idea what it was. And I actually didn't know how far back my memory goes, because the only thing this dude I really would have recognized him from was Emergency in the 70s.
Yes, this is the couple that we're about to see here is the great Randolph Mantooth.
Yes.
And Sybil
Shepherd.
Coming in at minute 31 for a cameo.
Admit, I saw her name in the credits and then had forgotten by the time they got to this point that Sybil Shepherd was in the credits.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing they said, Sybil, we'll pay you a bunch of money. And she said, I'll come in and do this 5-minute scene. I have no qualms with that.
This is definitely what we call a one day shoot.
Yes. So, yes, this is the glasses, Abigail's employers. She was like one of the family, is what the dad is saying. Mrs. Gless, Sybil Shepherd does some good acting here. I mean, there's some kind of unspoken thing going on between him and her. She kind of resents him.
She got this script and just wrote at the top of the page in magic marker, "I'm a harpy."
Mr. Glass is like, she was from Denmark, and Sybil is like, "Holland, dear." They ask her what kind of work she did. She was like the au pair. She took care of the child. They just had one child, their son, Roderick.
Roderick.
Mm-hmm.
Roderick. There's eight letters in Roderick.
Mr. Glass smiles at the thought of his son, gets up and goes and gets a picture he has framed of Abigail and their little boy.
Abigail has seven letters in it. Hansen has six. 876. We did it.
See? There's your connection right there.
Oy.
They were close, and Mrs. Gless says, oh, yeah, she practically raised the boy. And the husband says, oh, I wouldn't go that far. And she's like, no, well, what would you call it? And then she says, you know, Patrick likes to think he was a good father. I was like, damn, Sybil Shepherd. he says, why do you want to know about Abigail? They tell him they think it's going to be connection to the murders. And how old was your son when Abigail was found dead? He was 9. They weren't there when it happened. They were on a cruise.
Yeah, they were great parents, and she was one of the family. Jesus.
Yeah. And when they came back, they knew something was wrong because of the smell. They went up, and he was curled up next to her. She was dead, arms around him. It's how he fell asleep. She had been dead for 2, maybe 3 days. And yeah, so that's a horrible situation. Clearly it's Roderick.
Yeah, I think so. A, we know why he's all messed up. And B, like the great parents they are, they certainly got him right into therapy. Oh, wait, no, they didn't.
No, they haven't spoken for years, actually. He turned 21. He dropped out of medical school. Thank you for telling us that. And liquidated his trust fund. And Sybil Shepherd says, I knew he was troubled, but I had no idea he would ever hurt anybody. Mr. Glass is like, yeah, we don't know for sure. Come on, Mr. Glass, you know.
Like we just pretty much identified the end. He fits the profile like even better than Ivan.
They ask him when they last heard from him. And it turns out that Mrs. Glass got a letter about a year previous. She goes and gets it. Hotch is like, can we borrow this? And she says, you can have it and take this stupid picture with you, too. Yeah.
Cold comfort. She exactly. Puts the cold in cold comfort.
So next we cut to Garcia. She's basically clickety clacketing to confirm the information that the Glesses told them about Roderick. Yep, he got $500,000, but she can't figure out where he is now. Because he must be paying for everything in cash. We don't have any record on what he's been doing the last 4 years. No property or anything. Garcia is very apologetic. And Morgan says, you know, he's got to have to supplement his income somehow because $500,000, you know, ain't what it used to be. Meanwhile, Reed is looking at the letter. He's got nothing that points to any specific location. It's basically a goodbye letter. But only to the mom. It wasn't written to the dad. So Rossi is wondering about that. That doesn't seem right. So he's going to walk off and tell Garcia to check something else. And Morgan says, basically, we got nothing.
Yeah, I mean, look, I get it. It's a TV show. Rossi's going to have Garcia check something else because that's going to turn out to be the thing that is going to turn the case. And we don't need to know about it just yet. But, I mean, come on. You gotta hide it from the rest of the team? Really? Come on, Rosny.
Yeah. We cut real quick to Roderick. I'm just calling him Roderick. I don't think I'm going out on a limb there.
No.
And he's gently caressing Brooke, telling her he missed her, and she's like, oh yeah, me too. She thinks she's doing the right thing, you know, at this point. He has her drink something, and he's telling her it's the last time. And so she grabs it. It looks like tea, maybe, or something.
Yeah, it looks like they're having a little tea party, yeah, which is something that you would do with a 9-year-old, absolutely.
She drinks it down. She's barely conscious, and we get an artsy shot of him leading her down the hallway, but now he's a little boy, and it's Abigail, it's not Brooke, and they're walking, and she says, what is this place? And he says, it's a surprise, it's forever, and the camera does artsy lens flare type thing, almost like an alien type of shot.
And we see that he's going to put her on a slab and embalm her.
Yes.
It's great. And right before we had cut to Roderick, we did see JJ grab the envelope and the letter and then look at her ring finger. And you're just like, oh, no, JJ.
No,
please,
you're not going
to
JJ.
No, yes. JJ. Where are we cutting to now, Kentad?
Let's go over to Usher's house.
I need the fall of the House of Usher.
Yeah. But he's feeling the letter because JJ has brought it to him.
Well, hopefully now that he's going to come up with some sort of revelation. I can't wait to hear this astonishing pinpoint location where we can find Brooke. What does JJ report?
We're back at the police station and JJ reports that he's near water.
Near water in an episode where it has yet to stop raining.
As Reed points out, the earth is 2/3 water.
he's going to tell us that he drowned, even though he died at 9/11. Oh, wait, that's Sylvia Brown.
JJ does say he specified that you could see a rocky shoreline.
Okay.
From that, JJ has gotten a photo from the Glesses house that was on Mercer Island. It's a waterfront property. No one has lived there for the past 10 years. JJ has checked. It is abandoned. This could be where he's holding Brooke.
Okay. It is certainly possible. I agree. Let's send some people over there.
Before that, though.
Oh, wait, what?
Rossi walks in and says, hey, guess what? He's sending him money. And they're like, what the what? Mr. Gless is sending Roderick money. That's why Roderick didn't say goodbye to him in the letter, because they've been keeping in touch. Every 6 months, a $50,000 wire.
They're rich. It's okay.
Has been being wired. It's a Western Union. There's no way of telling who's getting that money. And Rossi says, I'm telling you who's getting the money. He is sending it to Roderick. If you had seen him, you know that this man is not neglecting his son. And Hotch agrees with that. He was felt very guilty about his neglect of him. So they're going to actually go, instead of Mercer Island, they're going to go talk to the mom and the Glesses again. Because, as Fullwood points out on the map where they figured out where the 911 call must have been from, where in that circle, that's where the Western Union is. Nowhere near Mercer Island where the house is.
Right. So we need to find a location within that circle that is important to the Glesses, or maybe Roderick has access to. But my question here, why not both?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are 100 cops in the back room there who've been, you know, I assume going out to all of the, I know that we didn't see, the BAU was the only people who interviewed the death business people, but I'm sure there were more than the three.
Right.
You mean they can't send like three of them to that address in Mercer Island just to see what's what?
Of course they should have. Maybe we didn't see it, AJ.
I'm just saying, they're making it seem like this is either we go with JJ and Mercer Island.
Right.
Or we go, again, we know that she's already on the slab. We need to find her in the next 5 minutes. But they don't know that. And then there's this weird smash cut.
Yes.
And Hotch, in the rain, is leaving the glass house, having just had some sort of conversation with the two of them. We've got a location.
Right. We don't see any of that. We don't see any confirmation. We do see Cybill Shepherd looking kind of pissed at Mr. Gless, but...
But that's because, you know, she just found out that he's been giving money to him, and they probably gave him the circle and say, where's the location in this circle? Because we know Roderick is the person and everything. And they probably gave him a location that means something to them or that they own or something. Are we still, like, this belief that they might still be going to Mercer Island? I just don't get it.
So next we go back to the embalming table. The fluid has already been hooked up to Brooke. Roderick has his little, you know, scrubs on.
And this is a scene that probably could be done in 30 seconds and three cuts, but this is some sort of artsy 5-minute long sequence now that they've decided, like, how much time is left in the episode? Stretch. Don't show the conversation where we're going to find out the information. Stretch.
He picks up the scalpel and is about to cut Brooke's neck. He's calling her. He's about to cut. And the FBI rushes in. And we see that they're at the right location. And they are able to grab Roderick. He's screaming for Abby. Is she alive? Fullwood wants to know immediately.
He looks back at the table. It is Abby in his eyes. As he gets taken away, he sees Abby, and Abby is sitting up smiling at him. And
yeah.
And then we cut back, and oh no, it's Brooke, and oh, she's still alive, maybe, but she, we got to get the EMTs in here. Clear, let's shoot something in her, wake her up. And then she sits up, and she's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Luckily, Hotch told the paramedics that she was on her barbiturate, so they knew exactly what to give her.
Sure. I mean, he assumed, just based on past history.
She's alive.
Hooray!
Fullwood looks relieved, happy. Everybody is happy. But Rossi has to do a little, I told you so. Some psychic, this guy is, she's near water. This place is far from a rocky shoreline as you can get. But Hotch is looking out the window, which is covered with a big, I'll just call it a curtain. It's not a curtain, but it's covered.
Tarp that's hung up
with
like
a tarp
to keep the looky-loos out because it's a giant window there. Now, one would argue here that Hotch is doing this like some sort of magician with a magic trick reveal. Like, and he rips the top off. Look, huzzah! But really... There is zero reason for Hotch to have looked out the window in the first place.
Yeah. He was having a conversation with Rossi, but instead he just wanders off and looks out the window and says, oh, look at this. He pulls away the tarp, and it's a big ad with the rocky shoreline for some beer, Turnpoint Ale. There's a lighthouse, a rocky shoreline, big mural on the side of the building across the way. Ooh.
And Rossi's looking like... Oh, my God, the psychic was correct, is the look on his face, like the astounding. It's like, uh-huh. Really? Really?
And we get a Rossi voiceover at this point. For those who believe, no proof is necessary. For those who don't believe, no proof is possible. Stuart Chase.
No. No. For those who don't believe, proof is possible, but it's got to be proof. Lord. And Brooke is brought to the ambulance, and the mom
reunited. Yeah, reunited with her mom.
Still thinks her name is Abby. Like she's still out of it.
And Hotch says, "Look, she's going to be okay. Thank God, she's going to be okay."
Indeed.
Let's go back to the BAU.
Okay. And again, this one is just way too on the nose. They go back to the BAU, and JJ has come into the office with an umbrella because even though they've gone from one Washington to the other, it's still raining. Come on.
I think it was taking the rain that much time to move from west to east. It's the same storm.
Oh, please. This is just a little bit too on the nose.
Who else is in the BAU office early? Rossi is. And his where he's got to have, I guess, the heart to heart with JJ, because, you know, they clashed a little bit.
They were on different sides of the argument. Yes.
But JJ tells him right away, look, if you're going to tell me not to believe in psychics, you don't have to. And Rossi's like, you can believe whatever the hell you want to believe. But when we're in working on the job, you just need to have faith in what we do. And JJ explains, look, I saw a mother losing her child and we didn't have any other leads. I thought what harm it could it do? Rossi says, look, I thought the same thing once. It was a kidnapping case in Georgia. We had nothing. Time was running out. There was a local woman known for her abilities. On her advice, we took the investigation in the wrong direction and the boy died. JJ's like, I'm sorry. Rossi says, well, it was a long time ago. And JJ answers the barometer for us. Guess we don't have to do it.
That's right.
Because she says, well, we won this time. That's what matters, right? And Rossi says, welcome back. And the camera pulls back and there's rain going down the window. And the episode
this conversation
ends.
Took place near water.
8-6-7.
JJ was, I wish JJ would just like, look, it was never about the psychic. It was about, I wanted to have hope. I just had a kid. This is a woman missing her kid. It, you know, first case back. We're cool. Like that would have been fine. And that is, it's essentially what she's saying. But as like, you know, I also wish Rossi would have gone a little harder on her. Like, if we had gone to Mercer Island and followed your stupid psychic, she'd be dead. That's really what he should have said to her. Like, not only did that one case in Georgia way back that nobody really cares about.
Right.
If we had gone to Mercer Island like you wanted, she'd be dead. So let's not listen to the psychics.
Yeah. So that was the episode, AJ. I didn't mind that episode. Maybe you minded that episode a little more than I did. But
I think it was the first time I watched it.
It didn't bother me.
I just thought a little. It was a little bit too pro psychic for my tastes. Like the maybe, and you know the ending. Just like you're like ho ho ho. Look, he was right after. No, it wasn't actionable. So no. Yeah, I just don't like stories like that in general. That promote the pseudoscience and the woo woo. Unless the show's about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know.
I gotcha. I think I enjoyed it for like the wrong reasons, like the mostly superficial reasons of like it was like almost a Love Boat episode because it had all these different guest stars.
I guess also for me, it's like, you know, this is the one, maybe not the one, but the most JJ is wrong. And JJ's never wrong. Like she's our rock. JJ is the one who gets stuff done. And this is the... I mean, yeah, she's going to have some episodes where she fumbles, but never like this. Like, this is, like, to me, the outlier. And, okay, first case back, just had a kid, needs time to get her feet wet. And with all the rain, of course, her feet are wet. But, yeah, I just I don't like episodes where JJ's wrong.
Okay. Very fair. Like I said, our barometer, I guess we can confirm, AJ, but...
Hey, we won this one, right? No, they did, because they didn't follow the psychic. And they didn't go down the wrong path. They trusted the profile, and Rossi did the legwork, and we found out who did it. So, yeah, it's a win. I mean, you know,
yep.
Silly ending, but it's a win.
Enough said. Let's tease it out and talk about episode 15.
Indeed. We've had some interesting episodes the last few weeks. Let's see if we continue with the occult. Here we go. What will be the plot, Kintad, of season 4, episode 15, entitled Zoe's Reprise? Zoe's Reprise. Is it A? A young girl named Zoe was kidnapped 15 years ago. So why does her mother think she saw her yesterday in the park? Is it B? An autistic child named Zoe hums the same tune over and over again, and it could be the key clue in finding out who killed her father. Is it C? While off on his latest book tour, an aspiring profiler named Zoe challenges Rossi to join her on a quest to catch a local serial killer. Or is it D? Zoe is a rising pop star, but her latest single seems to have inspired one big fan to kill in order to get her affection. Which of these is Zoe's reprise?
So there's going to be somebody named Zoe.
I mean, I think I locked that in for you, yeah.
Okay. I don't know, because all of these seem plausible to me, knowing this show. I kind of want to go, and I think I am going to go with choice D. She is a pop star. One of her songs has now gotten an unsub out there.
Okay.
To start killing.
Now, while I will, those of you who have watched Criminal Minds and are all caught up, including Criminal Minds Evolution, will know that all three of my fake answers will eventually be stories that we will cover. Just not with somebody named Zoe. But yes, they're all legitimate Criminal Minds plots. Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. However, next week, Kintad. Oh, Kintad. I mean, isn't it about time we go on a book tour with Rossi?
Oh, gosh. You know, I almost said choice C, and I did go with it.
We will be on that book tour and see what Rossi makes of a young aspiring profiler named Zoe who says, I think we have a serial killer in town.
Okay. I look forward to all four of these episodes based on the
And spoiler alert, they do.
All righty. Well, folks, thank you so much for hanging out. That is the show this week. I hope you had a great time. I'll say all the normal. Please subscribe to, rate, review our podcast on your favorite platform. We certainly appreciate that. Also, if you have friends that enjoy the type of content we provide, why don't you let them know about us? And also, you can write to us at feloniouspundits@gmail.com. Or follow us on Twitter @podcast_pundits. For AJ Mass, this is Kintad Svensgaard saying goodbye and keep profiling.
Wheels up. There is a distinct difference between having an open mind and having a hole in your head from which your brain leaks out. James Randi.